Accession number 28354, Reel 14.
You were presented with a jimmy.
Yeah, by the colonel commandant, a general, whose name I've now forgotten, who, poor man, embarrassedly had to ring me out next day and say, please, could he have it back again, because it was the wrong one, or there was something wrong with it. It wasn't the official model. But that commissioning service was very successful, and there were... There was a comeback on this. A lady I met some time later said, you've no idea how I hated you. What tiresome you were. And I said, well, why was that? And she said, you said to all of us wives, when you're writing to your husbands, try not to bellyache. Keep them happy. They're away from you and you're away from them. There's nothing they can do about it if you moan all the time. And you only make them unhappy by moaning. And try not to. I really would invite you to try not to. He said, I always remembered those words, and it was absolute hell. When I was writing my husband, I couldn't write what I really thought. I hated you, she said. So at least something I said had some effect on somebody, I thought afterwards. I'd never obviously commanded an aircraft carrier before, and we finally sailed for trials. And we left the jetty. The tugs turned us round because we were facing the wrong direction. We were starboard side too, and obviously I was pointing the wrong way for Portsmouth Dockyard. And the tugs turned us round and then let go, and I said, half ahead both. And the telephone rang from the engine room to say that they couldn't, that something had gone wrong, and they were stopped. So perhaps I'd not lost the tugs, perhaps I'd still got them. Well, we just hung around then, looking rather silly in the middle of Portsmouth Dockyard, not going either forwards or backwards. But eventually we went out of the harbour and I got her safely out. Of course, driving an aircraft carrier is quite different to driving any other ship, in that the bridge is on the starboard wing, and normally in a ship you are looking straight down the centre of the ship, the compass and everything. You can see the flagstaff and you can see how you're going, and in a carrier, of course, you're offset, and you have to allow for this, and allow for the fact that the boys on the port side disappear underneath the angle of the flight deck quite soon. You lose them quite a long way away, it seems. But it's not difficult. You soon get used to it. And we went out and then did all the trials, full speed trials, full power trials, and for catapult trials. No aircraft trials yet. It was just all the machinery of the ship. We tried the catapult out. I'm sad of this. It was by firing an ancient Bentley into the sea. But actually, you tried the catapults out by putting weights. They were done in the dockyard with weights. But when we went to sea, we shoved them. We then went right to Plymouth. We then ran to Portland, to do degaussing trials. That's the anti-mine thing that's wound around the ship. And no doubt various other trials. I can't remember what they were. But we did have on board an experimental system for helping a captain to come to a boy in a carrier. And that was obviously a television camera put in the eyes of the ship with a monitor up on the bridge. And we had to experiment with this and try it. So I took, on a Sunday afternoon, nothing happening in Weymouth at all, I took the ship quietly into Weymouth Harbour in order to pick up a boy using this camera. It was absolutely useless idea, because you couldn't get from the bridge with the camera an idea of distance or anything. It didn't help at all. It was much better having the chap on the telephone telling you what was happening from the forecastle than it was actually to see it yourself, because you couldn't get the perspective right. At least I couldn't, and nor could anybody else on the bridge. Anyway, we got to our buoy using this thing and abandoned it, and were able to say we'd done the trial and it was no good, don't do that again. And then we said, let's go out again. I had to go out again. And we let go of the buoy. And of course I was pointing right in towards Chesil Beach, right across the harbour, with my stern towards the entrance to Portland Harbour. So we had to turn the ship around 180 degrees. There was a theory in HMS Hermes that if the temperature in the LP turbine got above something or other, then you must stop because disaster was going to follow. The technical reasons for this don't remain with me. And anyway, they weren't true, but they were thought to be true. And it was very shallow in that harbour with this big ship, and we churned up masses of mud, and the turning moment from the screws simply wasn't sufficient. We got halfway round when the engineer officer was on the bridge saying, we have to stop the engine, sir, because the LP turbine is... Note, this is Sunday afternoon, and it was a lovely, lovely, lovely day. We were drifting round Weymouth Harbour. So we just... Oh, I know what I did then. We lowered all the boats, that's right. So we lowered every single motorboat and thing that we had and put them on as tugs to try and turn the ship. And, of course, they were totally ineffective and didn't move it at all. So we just, as the ship drifted across the harbour, we caught a buoy as we went by and helped ourselves onto it again and made a signal to Flag Officer, Sea Training in Portland Harbour, please, tugs. And the poor tugman had to come back, raise steam, get the tug, and took us out of harbour. We weren't very popular. We had to get out of harbour because something was no doubt happening the next day on Monday morning. This happened to me once again in that ship when I left the jetty in Palma, Mallorca, and we stuck in the harbour for an awful long time. Everybody ashore wondered what the hell we were doing, and I was sitting there waiting for the LP turbine to cool down a bit because I couldn't turn the ship otherwise. But in the next commission, they found that this was totally unnecessary and was a load of rubbish. But it wasn't found out during my commission. So we got out of...
How many tons was Hermes?
About 26,000. Got the ship out of Portland Harbour again and back to the sea trials. There's only one frightfully interesting thing now. This is really interesting to everybody. It's the only time in my life I have ever seen... Oh, damn, what's the bird in the Outer Hebrides that's so rare? You have to stop a second while I try to remember it. This is the only time in my life I have ever seen a corncrake, because early one morning while we were sitting off Portland there, I came up on the bridge and I said, crikey, what's that bird there? Give me my binoculars. And I said, it's a corncrake. I've never seen one, but I know that's a corncrake. And it was. A poor, wretched corncrake had landed on our forecastle in the fog. It's been very foggy in the fog the night before. Yeah, I'm glad to say it got off, and I hope it found its way to the Skye or somewhere where the crofters farm in a manner that the corncrake can survive.
Can I just ask you, what was your ship's company like and your officers?
Oh, their total lot with their crew was about 2,000. They were very good. They were a marvellous lot. I did write to my wife once to say that I really felt that I was totally spoilt, because I argued in a carrier that the only thing... I'm not going to break something. The only thing the captain needed to do, would be to walk onto the bridge and press the switch and say, approved to fly. All the other... He had so much technical wisdom around him He had a commander air who was an experienced aviator. He had an engineer who was an experienced engineer, all the way down the line. They were very experienced officers of commander's rank. It all should have been done for him, and he should just press that switch I put in your hand that was given to me when I left the switch, because I always professed this opinion that all I should be asked to do was to flick a switch. Inevitably, one has to do other things, I think. And in my case, I was terribly pleased with all these officers, and all my commanders became captains, bar one, the first supply officer didn't. He was less adequate than the rest of them. He wasn't quite the quality. And going down the line, down below that, there were one or two lesser folk who weren't quite so good, particularly in senior lieutenant commander's rank. There were one or two there who weren't quite the quality. My torpedo officer was very good, but communications signal officer was less of a stand. I couldn't rely on him in the ops room in the way I could rely on the others.
What would you rely on him for, exactly?
To be in charge of the operations room in ordinary defence watches and to react to some tactical emergency in the correct way. When you were not just yourself, I mean, you had other ships that you were commanding, possibly. Anyway, you always had a destroyer with you, because you always had somebody as your plane guard. There was one ship with you.
So who stayed astern to pick up people in case of
on your quarter? Yeah. Did you always have one, or did we rely on the helicopter? No, you usually had a plane guard. Though we did fly without them in exercises, obviously, because you had and did it with use the helicopters. I grew to admire the Fleet Air Arm enormously. I think they were those young men that flew those great big planes onto that wretched little deck. I admired very much. In the case of Hermes, you were first of all, you had too many aeroplanes. In the ship for the size of it. This was in order to try and make a more potent weapon system, but actually, in a way, it interfered with the deck and with the hangar so much, because you had too many aircraft, that you were, I'm not sure, we weren't a little less efficient than we might have been with less aeroplanes, because it was so hard to maintain them. But also you were flying very big and heavy aeroplanes onto a very small deck. Hermes' deck was relatively small, and also in a ship that had no speed. Her maximum of 24 knots, she really couldn't sustain more than 24, was not enough for a Vixen aeroplane to land with sufficient fuel to go round enough times if he made a mess of it. He had to get on, or he had to divert. Or he only had a 1 second chance. And equally with the Scimitar, if it was to get off with a decent bomb load, it had such a small fuel load that it had hardly any endurance. Or if it had a bit of endurance, and the Scimitar didn't have much anyway, it had no weapon load. So it was a balancing act, and you were inviting these young pilots in difficult conditions to do a very difficult thing without, I thought, really proper safety margins for them. And they did it marvelously.
Did you have accidents?
Oh, yes. Not a great number, but yes, we did. But that's... I'll come to them. And
okay. Yeah.
Finally, after we'd done all the trials, etc., we embarked the aircraft for the workup. And the carrier workup was a lengthy business, went through several phases. In fact, I was able to give my wife quite an exciting view of embarking aeroplanes, because we had a tanker with me. We're going out to the Mediterranean to work up, to Gibraltar actually, to work up. And my wife and my daughter, I put in the tanker to go down to the Mediterranean. And as we steamed out of Portsmouth Harbour, I managed to judge it quite nicely, so that we were hooshing past them at 24 knots, just as the first aircraft landed on board. And then we landed them all on board safely and proceeded on our way to the Mediterranean. We couldn't do any flying until we got down to the Mediterranean, because of not having a diversion, until the chaps were all fully qualified for landing on this ship, we couldn't do that. So we went down and started our first operational workup in the Atlantic, off Gibraltar. I had Admiral Hopkins on board, who was Flag Officer Aircraft Carriers, Rear Admiral Hopkins, DSO, DSC, a wonderful man. He started off as an observer in the war and then became a pilot, very unusually qualifying subsequently as a pilot. He was well known in flying the swordfishes from Malta, which is where he won certainly one of his medals. He's an extremely popular officer in the Fleet Air Arm and a very nice, able man. He was I couldn't have had a nicer aviator admiral for a non-aviator captain starting off on this journey in the Fleet Air Arm. He was very good, because not all aviators approved of non-aviator commanding officers, understandably. In a way, understandably, they're wrong, but I understand why. The details of the workup? We gave ourselves. This is where my inexperience came in. We gave ourselves two ambitious targets in the workup. We tried to do too much, too soon. That's to say, we tried to fly a program without having large pauses in between to mend or maintain the aircraft. And at the beginning of a commission, this was a mistake. We should. Now, this was my commander air, Pete Perrott, who was a very hard man, and reckoned, you know, that you've got to push people, and the only way to get it efficient was to push. And this was part of his push, and I fell for it, and I shouldn't have. We should have allowed them an easier start. We didn't. So the workup was more fraught than it, I think, probably needed to be, and we pushed people a little harder than we perhaps should have done. And the result is we often came to a grinding halt, because we'd over-pressurized ourselves. A good lesson, actually, but I think it impeded the workup slightly. Did we have any accidents, you asked earlier? We had one early on in the workup, when a Scimitar pilot, actually a chap called Wilson, spelt with two L's, who was the senior pilot of the Scimitar squadron, out on a sortie on his way back, had a total engine failure and had to bail out. And so we lost that aeroplane. He bailed out, and he was able to give us lots of notice. We knew exactly where he was going to bail out, and he was picked up instantly by one of the destroyers. And brought back on board. He was quite uninjured. That was the first accident. Next accident actually was a tragic and sad one off Malta. We were night flying. off Halfar, off the coast of Malta. And a pilot, his name's gone out of my head at the moment, a young man I'd already grown to like and admire very much. He was about 22 years old, extremely, extremely good looking, very able pilot actually. He came in to land, this was night flying as I said, came in too low and didn't correct soon enough. Hit the rundown with his aircraft instead of landing further up the flight deck, and skidded along the flight deck on his belly because he hit the rundown so hard that his undercarriage collapsed. And with his wing tanks on fire, with the friction of the flight deck, ignited them and went over the angle and straight into the sea, and both he and his observer died. Whose fault this was, I don't know. Anyway, the Board of Inquiry exonerated the air traffic controller. He was being brought in, obviously, at night by an air traffic controller, telling him he was on the flight path or he wasn't on the flight path. And he was shouted at us, too low, too low, too low, or whatever the shout is to come up, and didn't correct soon enough and hit the rundown. Nobody was blamed. It was one of those sad accidents. I felt I must admit being very upset at that one, and I remember being upset with myself at that one too, in that I froze on the bridge with the sight of this thing. And it was Bill Perkins, my navigator, who said full speed astern, both engines, not me. It ought to have been me. I froze for a sufficient time to have given the order. I don't think it could have been given any quicker, because Bill Perkins was sharp as anything on it. But it wasn't me, and I remember feeling a failure.
The aircraft was not recovered.
Hmm?
The aircraft was not recovered.
Oh, no.
It
went straight to the bottom, yes. Yeah. And there wasn't the facilities then for recovering it from fairly deep water. I said the workup was in three phases. We came back into Gibraltar after the first session. My wife by then was happily installed in the Bristol Hotel, so we had a very pleasant break at Gibraltar. But I found it took 24 hours to come back to being civilized after we got into harbour, working at the intensity we were during that workup. I really wasn't with it, and my wife also found I wasn't at all with it. I was distracted and worn out, actually, I think, really, mentally. Anyway, one recovered quite quickly, and it got better, obviously, as time went on. I can't remember when we did a second period off. I'm trying to remember when the final one was, off Malta, and I think the final period was again back off Gibraltar, when we did what was called our Operation Readiness Inspection, ORI, when we operated with another carrier being a nuisance to us and creating all the...
Acting as an enemy?
Acting as an enemy, yes, yeah. Well, we passed our ORI, God knows how, because the usual thing, at the very outset, the starboard catapult went US. So throughout the whole of this inspection, I only had one catapult. Probably a very good thing, actually, because the Admiral then could see what we did in a crisis like this with only one catapult, and presumably we did moderately all right, because we passed the ORI. I remember, but then I've always felt this after every inspection, I've always felt that I failed, because of course inspections are designed to make you make mistakes. That's the object of them. But when you're the when you are making the mistakes and seeing them happening, it's extremely worrying. And I was worried sick during that hour. I can't pretend but otherwise, and thought that we hadn't done too well. Oh yes, that's it. The 984, the whopping great radar, that enormous thing, that went US halfway through it. And again, that was another good test we had. You have other radars and you had to operate with them. But it was, you know, disappointing to see a ship you knew could do quite well, doing not too terribly well because of breakdowns. But Frank was as nice as possible over it and passed us. And then almost immediately after finishing that inspection, we were in a NATO exercise in the Atlantic with two big colossal American monster carriers, a French carrier, I think it was the Clemenceau, and Centaur, another British carrier. There's quite rough weather too, so this was a fairly testing affair. And we made a cock-up at the very beginning. We thought that we would get off to a really good start. So we had Mark 1 Wessex anti-submarine helicopters, which were very Mark 1, I'm afraid. They had a fuel system which was designed to fail, and was very difficult to make the helicopters start. You had a sort of machine that I can't remember, a sort of starter which wound up alongside the helicopter and then banged it off. And we put our two helicopters right in the front, right in the eyes of the ship, and behind it we had Vixen and the Scimitar on the catapult, and behind that all the airplanes lined up so that we'd get the most terrific initial launch. What we hadn't thought of was that the helicopters might not start, and one of them didn't. It wouldn't start. So this deck absolutely crowded with airplanes. We had to get this helicopter back, and that was a terrible task. We had to strike airplanes down to the hangar again in order to make a pathway.
Yes.
And this was one of those other mistakes you make. You're so clever to get off so well at the beginning that you foul yourself up totally. We did. Which didn't please Frank Hopkins terribly, because he was hoping to make a colossal impression with the Americans, and we were making no impression at all because there wasn't an airplane in the air for half an hour. A pity. But for the rest of the exercise, I think we did pretty well. It was a combined anti-submarine and air exercise. And I can't remember who we were fighting. Presumably it was the American carriers we were fighting, and they were fighting us, I presume. I can't remember now. But it was quite a big carrier exercise in quite rough weather, so we learnt a bit of rough weather operating, and went into Lisbon afterwards, and that was a nice rest there, and we had a post-exercise critique, or wash-up, whatever you call it, at which the British submarines produced photographs of the American carriers that they had taken through their periscopes as they ran undetected down the sides of the carriers. And this upset the Americans enormously, because carriers at that time were unsinkable. And submarines did not sink them. It never appeared in the report. No carrier was sunk. This was, I remember the joy of these two young submariner captains of producing these lovely photographs. The only carrier that wasn't sunk, actually, obviously, sunk in inverted commas in that exercise was mine. And though I may have been, indeed might have been, right at the end, I always argued that The captain of an aircraft carrier should never be an aviator. He should be an anti-submarine expert. The captain's job was to keep the carrier afloat so that all the experts, with their technical ability and their aviation knowledge, etc., could fight the ship safely because it was afloat. So he must be a good anti-submarine tactician. And that, whether I was a good one or not, I've no idea, but that's what I aimed to be. And I reckon I was successful in that operation totally. In fact, I'm sure I was, until the very last minute when the submarine did get within range of us. The Americans always had aviator captains. They had to be an aviator to be captain of a carrier. And they were totally incompetent, I think, in the tactics of anti-submarine warfare. And had there been a modern war with modern submarines, nuclear and other efficient submarines, they would have been sunk. I am in no doubt whatever about it. So would we, but we wouldn't have been sunk quite so much or so quickly.
Where did you learn anti-submarine warfare?
Well, you learned it by doing it. I don't think you learned it in